Our first speaker is Professor Thomas Luckmann from Konstanz, and we are proud that he still has some connection to its sociology today. He will speak about the constitution of experience.
I do feel responsible for the concept. I'm sorry for that. I will tolerate the word construction and even use it myself, but I will shoot anyone who will say social constructionist, or possibly scandal. My first lecture has something to do with construction and constitution. My second one has something to do with boundaries, although not boundaries among ethnic groups, nation states, but with a boundary that separates human beings from other objects, living beings, dead beings in the world, and the various historical boundary building from totemism to modern evolutionism. And I use this as an example of showing the links between a phenomenological analysis of the constitution of human experience, human activity of building worlds for themselves, of building realities, and the social science reconstructions of what is already constructed. The ways followed by human beings in their attempts to understand the world in which they live are generally guided by common sense. When in all but the simplest societies, theoretically more ambitious kinds of mythological, metaphysical, and eventually scientific modes of thought evolve from ordinary common sense, these in their turn succeeded to a greater or lesser extent in influencing the historical varieties of common sense. In most of these, we continue to take for granted, until further notice to the contrary, that whatever forces itself upon our awareness, whether from the outside, or what seems to be the outside, or from something inside, is real. A pebble in the shoe is real, and so is the answering pain in the sole of our foot. The rain is real, and the wetness of our skin. Just so, the book in the library and our reading of it, the rain, the handshake is a greeting and is a tactile sensation in our hands. All these are automatically constituted in our consciousness as varyingly distinct experiences of objects, events, and so forth. On the basis of preceding experiences, they are incorporated in the subjective stock of knowledge and thereby grasped as instances of types of objects, events, and so forth. We tacitly know that we could not experience anything without conscious activities, such as perceiving, remembering, thinking, but we also know that what we are experiencing is independent of our consciousness, with the exception of the special case in which we think about our thinking, remember our experiencing, and daydream of the future. The elementary assumption of common sense, however, may be considered naively realistic. We know that we do not see the forest when we close our eyes, but we also know that when we open our eyes, the forest will be there again. At least partly motivated by reflection on the special but not infrequent instances when something that we take for granted turns out to be problematic, something that seemed real, an illusion. Elaborate theoretical positions developed over the centuries. In these theories, the relation between consciousness and that which is grasped by consciousness was interpreted in different ways. Two of them entirely abandoned common sense. Following diametrically opposed directions, that led to radical materialism or radical idealism. Others did not divorce themselves from common sense in the same, to the same extent. Among these, one is especially relevant for the social sciences, not only as are all other forms of human thought, as a datum for the sociology of knowledge, but also as a possibility to be followed in their own attempts to describe and explain human reality. It rests upon what may be called an anthropological and an epistemological axiom. In providing the theoretical foundations of social science, it substituted a more sophisticated realism for the naive version of common sense. In modernity, it came to replace the mythological, religious, and metaphysical canopies of pre-modern common sense. In its first modern formulation, the anthropological axiom is to be found in Marx's anthropological writings. The world in which human beings live is, in an important sense, of their own making. A view of social reality as a human historical accomplishment was anticipated by a long line of historians and philosophers, from Aristotle and Thucydides to Vico, Montaigne, Montesquieu, and Adam Smith. Nonetheless, a comprehensive formulation had to wait until the 20th century, when Max Weber and after him Alfred Schütz and others took up the main epistemological and methodological issues connected to this view. Even if mostly undeclared, an axiom which one may call somewhat anachronistically constructionist supported the methods employed in analysis and explanation by many, if not most, social scientists in the following generations. The epistemological axiom is of Cartesian origin, the starting point for any serious attempt to account for the world is one's own awareness of the world. Lifting the axiom from its origin in a dualistic ontology, Edmund Husserl and in his successor, Aaron Gurwitch, Alfred Schütz and others, developed a modern non-Hegelian phenomenology in order to describe the constitution of the human life world without recourse to changing psychological and metaphysical facts. I intend to look at the relation between consciousness and that which is grasped by consciousness from the complementary vantage points of a phenomenological description of the subjective constitution of experience and a sociological reconstruction of the social sources of human reality. First, I shall try to show on a general level that a phenomenological, or as I prefer to say, proto-sociological description of the life world and the reconstruction of socially constructed historical worlds in the social sciences, although radically different in their approach to an understanding of human reality, complement one another. I shall begin by pointing briefly to certain elementary aspects of the subjective constitution and continue by a summary discussion of the social construction of human reality. In my second lecture tomorrow, I shall use an example to illustrate how these two ways jointly lead to a better understanding of the fascinating case of historically variable boundaries of the social world. The fact that the border between social and non-social reality is not identical, or was not identical, in all societies at all times, puzzled several generations of cultural and social anthropologists, as well as historians of religion. The puzzle was known as the problem of animism and totemism. Now, to phenomenology. The only immediate evidence available to each one of us, regardless of historically changeable states of scientific knowledge, is our own consciousness. Phenomenological analysis uses this evidence first to clarify the presuppositions of its own theoretical activities, and then to describe the specifically human nature of the reality with which the social sciences are concerned. It is a reality that is constituted in human consciousness, that's the epistemological axiom, and looked at objectively, it is a reality that is pre-constructed and reconstructed in human action, especially, although not exclusively, in communicative interaction. That's the anthropological axiom. The phenomenology of the life world, I propose, provides a general proto-sociology for sociological reconstructions of historical social worlds. Consciousness is nothing in itself. It is necessarily of something. But that which it is of, the object of intentional processes, which may or may not be an object in the ordinary sense of the world, has a universal structure. This structure consists of a thematic kernel of awareness that is enveloped by a thematic field, which again is surrounded by an open horizon. What is it that stands out as a theme in the stream of consciousness? That is a question that is not easy to answer. Very generally, it can be said that thematic kernels emerge in the stream of consciousness in consequence of an interrelated system of thematic, interpretational, and motivational relevance. But experience contains more than merely the actual presentation of a kernel of a topic, a theme. It involves continuing synthesis of the theme with the actual presentations of the kernel, with the retention of just past kernels of awareness and anticipations or potentials of future ones. And it also contains up-presentations in the case of this something that is presented to what is presented. In the case of perceptual experience, for example, the tail side of a coin is up-presented to the directly presented head. All experiences, in particular those in everyday reality, contain automatic presentations of a relevant type, a typification. This is a scheme of subjectively sedimented, interrelated thematic elements. Before experiencing a policeman as a policeman, we experience a human body as a typical shape with typical visual, tactile, olfactory components which belong together and form an elementary experience of the human body. Although what is directly presented at a given time may be only a distant, visual form. Before, of course, is to be understood in the logical, not necessarily in the temporal sense. The most primitive source of any kind of meaning is located right there, in the automatic constitution of themes as typical objects, whether these are perceptual, recollective, fictive, logical, judgmental, and so forth. Themes may simply follow one another in the stream of consciousness without any active involvement of the self, as in some forms of daydreaming. But we may want to reserve the term experience for such sequences of themes which do not merely run off by themselves, but in which the self is actively engaged, to which the self is paying some attention. Experiences are characterized, in addition, and as a consequence of this kind of involvement, by a higher degree of clarity and distinctness of the themes, and by a higher degree of consistency among the themes that follow one another. Nonetheless, a specific meaning of experience emerges only in a further and more complex conscious activity. It is constituted in retrospective, or one may say also reflective, grasps of experience that has just come, of an experience that has just come to an end, or of a phase of an experience that has just passed. And the experience is thus thereby placed in a context that goes beyond the simple givenness in ongoing awareness. Meaning is thus constituted in the consciousness of a relation, of the relation that obtains between a concrete experience and something else. That something else may be a past experience, and the kind of relation may be one of similarity, another man in that kind of uniform, another policeman, or it may be a typificatory scheme, this is a policeman, or a social norm, don't jaywalk when you see a policeman. The why and the how of the active performance of the mind in which the meaning of experience is constituted in this kind of relationship depends again upon subjective relevance systems and on the situation. The subjective relevance systems determine in considerable measure not only the original experience in which, but also the experience in which the meaning of the past experience is constituted. They also determine the action context in which both the original and the subsequent interpretive experience is located. Now turning to sociological reconstructions. It stands to reason that the empirical sciences cannot be ontologically neutral. They must accept, in general principle, the claim of the world as it presents itself to human experience, that it is real. Skepticism must be addressed to the specifics of that claim. It cannot logically pertain to its basic principle. Human experience is certainly fallible, and details that present themselves as facts may turn out to be illusory. But the fact of all facts, that the world is there, cannot be ignored without self-contradiction. Trying to account for the fallibility of human experience makes sense only if one accepts that basic claim. In other words, the empirical sciences must subscribe to some version of ontological realism, while returning to common sense as a stopping point, they must substitute the anthropological and epistemological axioms for the naive realism of common sense. However, what does ontological realism mean with regard to the specific reality of the social? Two opposing positions stand. In simplified form, one argument is that one looks at the cosmos, including that tiny part of it, which is the human world, objectively, from the outside. And that is that. The opposing argument accepts a common cosmological perspective, but with a difference. When asked, the human world too should be looked at from the outside, that is, as a reality that is to be objectively observed, described, and as best as one can explain, this position, which I find immeasurably more convincing than the other one, maintains that the human world also has an inside, that it is a world of individual subjects, of persons. In fact, the matter can be expressed in a seemingly absurd statement. The inside is the outside. The anthropological axiom implies that social worlds are made by people for people, by individuals as acting persons, as actors on a stage with other actors, following the stage directions of historical social institutions. To be sure, the social sciences investigate the world of human affairs in which the laws of mass and energy, of gravitation, and the laws of evolution and genetics are valid. However, these laws do not explain what we want to know about that world. When we see a person falling from the 10th floor of a building, we want to know whether it was murder, suicide, or perhaps a desperate attempt to escape fire. It is not just an instance of the law of gravitation. Of course, no gravitation, no suicide or murder of that kind. Nor do the laws of evolution help us much when we want to explain why Orthodox Christianity and not the Mithras cult became the state religion of the Roman Empire under Emperor Theodosius. Why the medieval Norse settlements in Greenland disappeared, but not the Inuit colonizers. Or when we want to understand the causes of the Great Depression. The physical sciences seek to explain a cosmos which has nothing to say, except in a purely metaphorical sense. It is a world to be looked at, described, and explained objectively, objectivity being accomplished by the inter-subjective agreement of the community of investigators about measurement, mathematical modeling, and so forth. On the other hand, the social sciences investigate a world which has something to say, which in fact has been saying something all along. Before any scientists will listen. The social world is the intersubjective accomplishment of the entire human community over many, many generations. It is naturally artificial, to use a term which was introduced by Helmut Plessen. The tradition of life by which human societies are organized are an artifice, the cumulative result of long chains of interaction by naturally artificial individuals. The universe, the earth, the living species all have a history which is independent of human activities. The human social world is historical in a more specific sense. It is a small part of life on Earth, where the human species emerged in evolution. Yet, the human social worlds are not a direct evolutionary product, but the product of an evolutionary emergent history. In other words, they are the result of human activity over generations. More or less obligatory ways of doing things, traditions and institutions, are not genetic programs. They are constructed and sedimented in a collective memory, in social, primarily, if not exclusively, communicative interaction. Traditions and institutions may appear less tangible than buildings and artifacts, but they are equally real. They were built up in human interaction, just as buildings and artifacts. Social worlds are communicative and historical systems, historical stocks of knowledge and historical institutional structures. These are constructed, maintained, transmitted, transformed, and occasionally destroyed in social interaction. Obviously, social interaction is more than individual action, but it presupposes individual action, and individual action is intentional, and intentional activities are meaningful to those who engage in them. They are meaningful to them when they lead to results that they were intended to achieve, and they are meaningful in another, more painful sense, when the consequences differ from those that were originally anticipated. Adorno is reported to have said in 1968, "This is not the way I thought of it." So habe ich es nicht vorgestellt. I'm not sure whether this is historical fact or whether it's just a bent of eye. Action is intrinsically meaningful, no matter whether the bridges that we built to endure or fail, whether the marriages that were meant to last or collapse. The meaning of individual action is, of course, subjective, but most of it is derived from social stocks of knowledge. And of course, social stocks of knowledge do not arise from nothing. They are built up in long chains of communicative social interaction that consists of coordinated, synchronized, individual action. Individual action, in its turn, presupposes intentional activities whose meaning is essentially derived from social stocks of knowledge. In view of this, one is tempted to say dialectical relationship between individual and collective levels of reality. It will be worth looking briefly at the link between the construction of the social world and the reconstruction of a social world in the empirical sciences. The social sciences reconstruct small parts as well as larger wholes in shorter as well as longer stretches of historical social worlds, that is, of something that has already been constructed as a social reality. Moreover, just as in earlier times, literary transformations, epic, fictional, etc., of common social reality influence the way people build up their social worlds or revise their social worlds, social science reconstruction, economic, political, sociological, and, of course, psychological, may enter the common sense construction of it. I take it that there is agreement on the basic principle that the data of the social sciences are communicative constructs of what are already interactional and most often communicative constructs. The data of the social sciences, as those of the classical humanities, are derived from these. Because the data are reconstructions of meaningful social action, and its results. In a historical world, they are to be formulated as data in a way which preserves rather than destroys their essential meaningfulness and historicity. Reconstructions are a particular, essentially narrative kind of communicative activity. Outside of the strict rules of evidence that govern such activities in the context of science, narrative reconstructions in oral face-to-face communicative interaction are part of a common pre-scientific level of social discourse. Their special importance is due not only to the circumstance that they are that a family and group supporting conversational machine, as Berger and Kelly called it once, but also to the fact that they are the chief source of the collective memory of families, social groups, institutions, classes, for societies. The stabilization of communicative patterns and their fusion into distinct genres serves the same purpose as institutionalization of social interaction. It frees, it liberates the actors on the social scene from the need to improvise when facing recurring communicative problems. For example, how can different aspects of past events and actions be best communicated for different purposes? How, when, and to whom? How can collective action be planned? How are successive generations to be introduced to the notions of right and wrong, good and evil? These are three particularly important areas of communication, important for establishing and maintaining social order in a society and in the communities of life, communities of ideas, and communities of emotions, which form part of a society. Communicative genres will be associated with them in all societies. In a sense, reconstructions of social reality in the social sciences may be considered another genre of reconstruction, or rather a family of genres. The reconstructions in the social sciences follow the rules of evidence that regulate the generation of data in all science. At the same time, they remain a narrative genre. They reconstruct what was already constructed. And that which was constructed presupposes the universal structures of the human life world. The description of this structure by a phenomenological proto-sociology provides the translation code by which the historical social realities reconstructed by the social sciences may be compared to one another. Without comparison, generalization is impossible.